Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. I hope you're having a good day today. I have with me Rosa Abreu-Runkel, who is an assistant professor at New York City College of Technology. And I want to say that Rosa just told me that this is her first podcast interview. So I'm very excited to be bringing you this premiere interview of her new book, Vanilla, A Global History. And I have to say that my listeners may know this already. I am a fan of the Edible series. I've already interviewed the author of Avocado. And last week we talked about Saffron. And I think this is a brilliant series. Each book is small. It's really a lovely gift size. And it gives a really nice focus, a nice history of a lot of foods that seem commonplace these days. Some are a little more exotic. And it's really lovely to read about the history, how we got to where we are today with respect to a particular food. Some of the news is delicious, some of it is delightful, and some of it is a bit scary. And that's the truth about everything in life. So I'm going to welcome Rosa to It's All About Food to talk about vanilla. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Great.
Be excited to be part of the podcast.
Good. So before we talk about the book, Vanilla, A Global History, can we learn a little bit about you? Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been doing most recently.
Yes. Well, I actually am a graduate of the hospitality program of New York City College of Technology. And I went into, you know, the industry hospitality. I work with major hotel corporations. After 18 years of experience in food and beverage, I returned back to the college to give back and teach the industry leaders. So since 2013, I've been full faculty there. And my passions is travel and wine. Obviously, you can't do that now. Wine, yes, not travel. And always curious about culture.
Yeah, so hospitality management right now is having a very hard time. We can't ignore what's been going on for almost a year now, COVID-19. And how has that impacted you and your life and your teaching?
We actually been out of the classroom since March 19th, and we have been teaching online. And we try our best, my colleagues in the department, to connect with one another via Zoom, obviously. And doing a lot of readings, writing projects that have been revised to adapt to this new normal that is online teaching. Yeah. So it's been a little difficult for faculty as well as students to adapt to this.
Yeah. Going forward, how do you think hospital management will change in terms of COVID? We all are very hopeful that we will get control of the spread of this, but I think it impacts all of us in certain ways, and we've learned a lot. So things definitely will change and improve.
Yes. Well, now it's restaurateurs and hoteliers are basically, they never had, you know, they had the old model and they went by this. And now they had to reinvent it into all of these safety precautions and obviously working with less staff. Some places obviously would not reopen back up. They're gone forever.
Yeah.
So now the reinvention and the thought process of hospitality management is concentrating in the healthcare industry, concentrating in the industry for the elderly. So sort of changing a little bit and reinventing what we're teaching our students. So we're in the process of that at this point.
Yeah. Well, it encourages creativity.
Yes.
Which is a good thing. Hard times make us dig deep. And I like to think make us better. Okay. So let's dig into Vanilla, A Global History. The first thing I like to ask the authors of the Edible series is how they got chosen to write their particular book.
Well, it's funny because I got introduced to the Edible series. I picked up the book Rice, which gave me a sort of a short and quick, about historical and rice. I was doing a paella presentation, which was, paella, sort of comparing it to culture. And that was my first introduction to the series itself. And I was looking for a topic to write. And one day I was reading the Wall Street Journal, and the article was about the shortage of vanilla specifically in Europe. And it was due to the, you know, global warming and all the storms that were passing through Africa. And it sort of hit me in the sense that I sort of reflected on it. I remember vanilla as being part of my childhood. I come from the Dominican Republic. Vanilla, our vanilla, obviously, I discovered through this research, is not, it's imitation vanilla, not the pure one, but it has a very strong scent. And I remember my mother making all these wonderful desserts and that scent of vanilla. And that's how I sort of said, you know what? This is the topic. And I wrote to the editors at Reaction Books to see if they were interested in the topic. And then, so it all started from there.
Well, you hit on a lot of topics that I want to dig into a little bit more. So I'm glad you mentioned them. And I thought I would save climate change for last, but let's talk about it now because it is front and center. And for 4 years, the administration in the United States was not paying any attention to it, ignoring it as if it didn't exist. And we've seen a lot of repercussions, and we're going to see a lot more as time goes on, but it definitely has impacted vanilla. I noticed because the price went up, and like you, I read about it, and I learned about the weather problems in Madagascar. So can we talk about the different places that have been impacted and how they've been impacted and how it affects vanilla?
Well, as you mentioned, Madagascar is in another area in Africa, obviously because of the hurricanes, it damages the vines. Mm-hmm. The vines are extremely fragile. And so that's one issue. In Mexico, since the monopoly of vanilla was no longer, it lasted for a few hundred years, it was no longer the case. They began turning their vanilla vines, where they had the vanilla vines, into farming land. And global warming, because of the fragility of the vine itself, it causes vanilla to be, you know, not in great production. It has to have the right humidity, has to right the right sunlight. So it needs to be nurtured. And if a storm passes by, if it's too hot, it is too cold, it just simply just destroys it. So it's global warming. It is a problem for the future of vanilla, obviously, and other crops, but specifically for vanilla.
Now, what was surprising to me reading about the history of vanilla, my short-sighted, limited understanding of vanilla before I dug into it and read your book or read anything about it, was that I knew Madagascar supplied vanilla because I would see it on the labels of some of the high-end vanillas. Tahitian vanilla was another one. And I didn't realize that Mexico was really where the history was the greatest in terms of vanilla. Can you talk about Mexico and vanilla? How it rose and how it fell and rose and...
Yeah, of course. So obviously the indigenous in the great cultures of Central America in North America, because Mexico is part of North America. And so they've known about vanilla because it grew wild in the wild. They were not really cultivated thousands of years ago before the Spaniards, you know, obviously arrived in the New World. And they were using it for medicinal purposes, for snake bites, for all type of things, including they used it as incense for their temples to the gods. So they had the knowledge of it, including that it was an aphrodisiac. And they mixed it with, obviously, with the chocolat, which is, we know now as chocolate. They obviously, through centuries of different indigenous groups or societies, they already had vanilla. They already cooked with it. They were familiarized with it. and until Cortez, who actually was the one that, you know, as we know historically, was able to conquer Mexico, he had one of his soldiers who noticed that the Aztecs were drinking this thick brew that was kind of bitter, and Montezuma, who was the king, was drinking all these cups of this brew, which the Spaniards found to be absolutely gross because it was bitter and thick. And it turned out to be that it was one of the main ingredients was vanilla. And the Tarahumara people, the indigenous people, out of all of them, they were the ones that adopted vanilla as giving by the gods to their culture. And they revered vanilla. So, you know, they have these stories that were passed hand down from one generation to another of you know, how the gods gave vanilla to them. And they were the custodians of the vine. And until years later, obviously, they were no longer, but they took it very seriously. They actually went into the wild, gathered the vanilla pods, and came back, but did not divulge where these vines were to be found.
Mm. It's all a very good story. And in it, we continue to hear about how humans abuse other humans. There's castes and slavery and all that ugly stuff that humans continue to do, unfortunately. And in this case, it was the Spaniards coming in and colonizing and taking over. I was chuckling to myself because recently I was hearing some conversations about how in current time we're obsessed with health and well-being and all these foods that are good for us. But that's been true throughout history. You talked about this Aztec brew. We've always been looking for what we can consume to make ourselves strong and or virile and healthier. So I don't think it's anything new. I also wanted to mention, in terms of the farmers and the distributors, specifically with Madagascar, but I'm sure it applies in other places, in that the farmers typically don't make a lot of money to grow vanilla, harvest it. And it's the distributors who are adding value to the product and making most of the money. And so when there's a shortage and the price goes up, most of the farmers still aren't benefiting from that. Is that true?
Correct. So the farmers don't make a lot of money. They're in the ground, you know, their families, the entire families are tending to the plots and tending to the crops. They are, you know, bound. They don't have the means to have someone representing them to sell it to the actual companies, you know, the Hershey's of the world, the McCormick's. They don't have that. So the farmers, before the vines or before the beans become mature, they pick them green and they sell it to the middleman. And the middleman is the one that makes the money. And you know, and the unfortunate part with vanilla is that there's several things attached to it. It is robbery, there is murders. There is corruption in so many of these countries in terms of the local government. You have the women who are most, and the children that are the ones that are mostly in the fields picking, because it's handpicked. It cannot be it cannot be picked by machinery. So they pass days and hours picking the beans themselves by hand. And just like when the vine itself needs to be the flowers, which once the flowers open up, they need to be pollinated the same day or else they fall, they die, and there's no beans. So you also will have the women and children using a little stick or bamboo stick to hand pollinate the flowers in order to become, you know, obviously produce the pod of the beans that we see in the market.
That part is fascinating about vanilla. So I guess the wild vanilla is pollinated by specific bees. And then when we cultivate it, we up the yield by manually pollinating. And it, as you said, it's complicated because you have to keep an eye on it and you have to see when the flower is opening up, go in there, do the pollinating, and then your yield is improved.
Correct. So the story of how vanilla becomes mass produced is obviously the glossening bees, which is very, very small little bees that will go into the flower. The flower has, you know, both it has the ovary, it has the male, the pollination of it. So the bees itself go in to find food, and they go inside, and then they get to the sticky part of the obviously the pollen that sticks to their body, and they go further in and they actually pollinate the plant. So that's the natural way of doing it. So obviously there was a monopoly in Mexico of the wild vanilla because the indigenous people didn't know how to do commercial. They just went into the wild. So the Europeans bought cuttings into different parts different parts of Africa, Java, Madagascar, Reunion Island, which was called Bourbon at the time. And so they bought cuttings to see if it grew there. However, the plant never flowered. It never flowered. And it flowered, but it never produced the beans. So there was this mystery about it until this young boy, Alvius, he was a slave boy in Reunion. And so he lived in this plantation, which the owner was basically into holoculture. And they used to, you know, walk around every day and look at the plants. And all of a sudden, he saw that the 22-year-old vine all of a sudden had a bean. How did it happen? And the young 12-year-old slave boy just simply said, well, I basically did this to the plant. And he said, no, I can't believe, you know, so many people trying to find commercially how to do this. You know, how European scientists are trying to find a way to do this. And you show me how did you do it? And he showed them how to do it, which was a little small little stick, bamboo stick, stuck it into the flower, and it produced the bean. And here we go. That was the mass production, multi-billion-dollar business. This is why it is pollinated by hand today. Cannot be done any other way. And how this Alvius became, you know, in Reunion, he's a superhero. However, to the fact is that he died in prison, destitute. He was given his freedom, but never saw a dime. He actually trained all the other slaves around the islands on how to do this pollination of the actual flower, but never saw a dime from it. And he ended up in jail and died.
I'm pausing for a moment in his memory, and I'm glad that you're sharing the story. At least we can think about it and somehow bring this to the future and think, how can we celebrate those who pay attention and really have a love for nature and how beautiful and complicated it is. And it takes the words away from me because it's just terrible, the cruelty that we inflict on others for our own personal benefit. And I think that we should keep that in mind when we consume vanilla or other foods with a certain amount of gratitude that we're able to have it. And for those, all of those in history that have brought it to our home and our plates and our palates. So let's move on here. I love that you brought up the word vanilla, not just the plant vanilla, and how in current times we've morphed it. I don't even think we realize how much we love vanilla. And we can talk about all the things that are in vanilla in a moment, but the word vanilla also means bland and means ordinary. And we use it as a negative connotation in so many forms. You talked about music and just flavor. I'm glad you brought it up. And it's just so confusing to me how you do something like this. In thinking about vanilla being bland, again, it's something about being mindful, because you talk about all the foods that vanilla is in. We know it's in pastries and sweet things, but it's also in savory sauces and things that we never imagined vanilla would be in, because most of us love vanilla and we don't even realize it because we take it for granted. Was that something surprising to you when you were writing about it?
When I started the research, I sort of wasn't just the sweet parts of it, right? The pastries and the ice creams and all that stuff. And as I started researching the chemical compounds of it and how it complements the savory foods, it was an aha moment. That I didn't realize that you could use it in eggs, that you could put it in butter, you could put it in salad dressings, and even, you know, like corn soup, which is one of the recipes in the book. And it's sort of like, yeah, it makes sense. It sort of makes sense in the palate and how it sort of adapts itself from the pastry to the savory and everything else that we use it. And we take vanilla for granted. It was something that was revered. When it became commercial, we adapted it and it became a language. It became, in the music that we listen to. It's part of us, and we don't even realize it, how important it was as a spice and a commodity. You know, it's called a black gold. And so I had more respect for vanilla after I wrote the book for that specific reason.
Yes, definitely. More respect for vanilla.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was talking about saffron last week from the Edible series. And I like saffron, and I'm adding it a little bit more to some of our foods since I've been talking about it and studied it. But I can live without saffron. I can't live without vanilla. And I don't think a lot of people want to live without vanilla. And it's not bland, and it's important. So it's just surprising, maybe a little upsetting, that we take the word and the product for granted. And now with climate change happening, it may be more and more difficult as time goes on to actually experience vanilla. And you were raised, as you said, on synthetic vanilla. Is that correct? Yeah. So what's different between the synthetic man-made version, which can come from, I mean, when you talk about the things that synthetic vanilla can be made of, it doesn't sound very appetizing. And the natural vanillas, and not all natural vanillas are the same based on where they come from.
Yes, correct. So you have obviously the Madagascar vanilla, which is the best, you know, it has the best quality. There comes the Mexican, and then you have the Indonesian one. And depending on the variety, there's so many hybrids out there of vanilla, but those are the ones that are more recognized. So the difference between the synthetic and the natural is obviously diluted in alcohol. Some organic ones are not diluted in alcohol. So it releases the flavor in the alcohol itself with time. And it has, it's sort of like a little, it's a brownish color, and it has the sweet smell to it. Mm-hmm. As opposed to synthetic, depending, it's many times it comes from the bark, you know, the pulp of trees that are the trees that I made paper from, that has that somewhat close smell to it. So that's the synthetic one. Close smell to the vanilla itself. And you also have the tonka beans, which actually they're outlawed here in the United States. And the tonka beans has comadrin, which again has the smell of it. But the problem with that is that it is toxic to the liver. And so there is a lot of substitution for vanilla itself, because there are products out there there trees out there that comes close to the smell and taste of it. Mm. And so when I was growing up, this particular vanilla, or what we call Dominican vanilla, which is really, you argue to a Dominican about their vanilla and they think that's the original. And it's sweet smelling, but has a potent smell. It has a sweet smell to it that is really potent when you use it in any desserts. As opposed to the real one, it's really subtle. And depending what country they come from, they will complement ice cream, they complement cake and cookies, they will actually complement the savory, or they'll be used in perfume. So now what turned out to be is, depending on the beans that are used, the one from Madagascar is, in Mexico, is more for cooking, as opposed to the Tahitian one, which is a hybrid. It's mostly the Tahitian is used for cooking, but there's one that is mostly not known, which is called Vanilla Pompona, which is usually used for perfume.
I wanted to mention, when we were talking about people not getting credit for the work that they've done, there was another slave that you talk about in your book, who was a personal slave of Thomas Jefferson, who brought vanilla ice cream to this country, James Hemings.
Yes. So, you know, we give credit to Thomas Jefferson, obviously, for bringing vanilla to the United States and popularizing it. But what I discovered while I was diving deep into Jefferson's, I got in touch with a chef that is part of the Hemings Society. And he is writing about Mr. Hemings, who is actually one of the sons of Jefferson, right? And
so it was one of his sons, and he was a slave. Lovely.
Correct. So he traveled to Europe. He traveled to Europe with Jefferson, and he's actually, and he's not recognized for this, he is the first American chef that is trained in French cuisine. Mm. And this is what this particular chef is actually writing a book about. And obviously Jefferson has this ice cream recipe. Well, Jefferson was not cooking. He had his personal chef. He didn't make this ice cream. It was Hemings that did this ice cream. So I take responsibility for saying that it was Hemings that actually did, you know, cooked and did the ice cream. And obviously, because who Jefferson was, he popularized this ice cream recipe and vanilla in the United States.
Wow. Once again, we don't treat people the way we should.
If we're thinking at this moment, it seems to be that it was Hemings that actually, it's his recipe and not Jefferson's.
Sure. I'm sure it was.
Well, there's no proof to it. Yeah, there's no proof to it, but yes. We're concluding that that was the case.
Of course. Why would it be Thomas Jefferson's recipe? He wasn't in the kitchen, right?
No.
Okay. Do you have a favorite now? You grew up with this synthetic vanilla, but I'm sure you've tried a variety of vanillas. Is there one in particular that you like?
I like the Mexican vanilla and the one from Madagascar. So I interchangeably use it in different recipes. So, but I also buy the bean itself, mm-hmm. where I, you know, put it in sugar and then you make vanilla sugar with it. Or, you know, if I'm doing ice cream from scratch, I simply take the bean, split it in half and scrape off the seeds and obviously make ice cream from there and follow the recipe and follow and do the ice cream from there. So, but another interesting part of it is, you know, this whole French vanilla that, you know, people see it on the market. There's no such thing as French vanilla. it obviously, you know, the Reunion Island was named Bourbon because of the French, and in somewhat of a marketing ploy, they now say it's French vanilla, but there was.
That's funny. And I agree with you. And I realized this when I spent 4 years living in France in the early 90s, things that I thought were French, they had other names. We have French dry cleaning here. What is that? So there's a lot of things that we give French credit for. And it's, I don't know, I guess in some ways it elevates it in our minds, in our crazy minds. With respect to ice cream, now I'm a vegan, so I don't eat dairy anymore. And I haven't for over 32 years. But I have this memory of Breyers ice cream and the commercials where they talked about the tiny specks of vanilla in the ice cream. And it just left a wonderful impression on me. And yet I still haven't cooked with vanilla pods and scraping the black seeds. And it blows my mind that I haven't done that. So that's on my new list. I need to work with the actual vanilla seeds. As I mentioned, I'm vegan. And so I was looking at your recipes and there are plenty of them that can be veganized, which is good because we have substitutes for milk and butter and cream and just about everything, even eggs. And I'm looking forward to trying some of them and putting vanilla in some savory things like this tomato sauce that you have that has vanilla in it. Just like, oh, I wonder what that tastes like. I remember when I first had ginger in tomato sauce and someone was saying, do you know what's in there that makes it taste this way? And it wasn't obvious to me until I was told that ginger was in there. And I was, of course there's ginger in there, but what a lovely combination. And I can't wait to try vanilla with tomato. And maybe I already have and didn't realize it, but that's something that I'm going to do. Anything else that we need to mention about vanilla? Was there anything surprising in your research that we didn't cover?
Well, what's surprising is still, there's like the United States is trying to get into the, you know, business of, you know, having a vanilla crop in Florida. So they're trying to see how can they get in it. Because obviously the vanilla manufacturers, if you go to the store, it's a natural product that says natural vanilla, it costs more money than synthetic. And obviously, you know, in recent years, we have consumers that are savvy and they want to be, you know, eating healthy and not synthetic products to be part of their, part of the products that they buy. And so thinking of ways on how they're going to possibly grow vanilla in Florida. Mm. So there are researchers that are looking into that. And, we've seen, you know, gradually throughout the years, how vanilla production has decreased through global warming. The vanilla production has decreased, the price have increased, and it becomes obviously more, the products that we purchase with vanilla becomes more expensive as well. So it's going to evolve. I don't know if there's some way that, or maybe in the future, that scientists will find a way to make mass production of vanilla not so much on the ground where women and children are part of it. Mm. Who knows? That could be something in the future.
Well, I think at the very least, we could balance some of the money that's taken in where the farmers, the producers, the harvesters, the people involved in making the vanilla, really with their hands, getting their hands dirty, get the bulk of the income, and the distributors don't get as much because they don't do the work. But that has to change. Our whole culture needs to change. We're starting to have a little more respect for the essential workers.
Yes.
The people that do the critical work. Now, vanilla probably isn't an essential ingredient for nutrition, but it certainly helps enjoy our foods, and it helps to consume other foods that are very nutritious because it adds a nice subtlety. It takes away the bitterness. And I think for people who are trying to lose weight, for example, and they want to limit the sugar that they're taking, when you add a little vanilla, you seem to need less sugar. It implies sweetness, even though it isn't sweet. Well, we have a lot of work to do, don't we?
Rosa Abreu-Runkle.
Thank you for joining me today and talking about your book, Vanilla, A Global History. I really enjoyed it, found it fascinating.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yes, and congratulations. You have now completed your first podcast. May there be many more.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Be well. Bye.
Bye.
That was Rosa Abreu-Runkle, author of Vanilla, A Global History. And now to continue this yummy vanilla conversation, we have Gary DeMattei.
Otherwise known as Vanellate.
Gary Vanellate? That's
Vanellate,
a new one.
Because I love vanilla. And
you know,
I love...
speaking of Vanellate, I used to really love vanilla tea.
Yes. I used to love when we had vanilla tea.
We don't do vanilla tea anymore because we don't drink much caffeine.
Realized that caffeine is not good for me, but that's old news. What is new news is some of the things you talked about today in this book, Vanilla, A Global History. Now, this is the third in a series, correct?
There are lots of them in this series.
But series.
Yeah, I just discovered it recently, and I may have to catch up because there's years' worth of these different books that focus on food. They're really adorable. But yes, this is the third. We've talked about avocado, which was so fascinating.
Yeah, that was really fascinating. And then, we both love avocado.
Yes, and then saffron. And yes, everyone, Gary finally did make me
risotto
with organic arborio rice and saffron, and
right.
Yum.
It was good, right?
We have like 7¾ pounds left of arborio rice, so
right.
You've got to make some more risotto.
Oh, definitely. I had lots of fun making it, and we have a great recipe if you want to try making it as well at Responsible Eating and Living. It's under Risotto Veganese. And you are going to need some saffron, and you are going to need some arborio rice. But that saffron interview was great.
Yeah, and then we just heard the vanilla
but
interview.
But I am such a fan of vanilla, and I think you know that.
Yeah, well, that's what I was saying, where both vanilla and saffron are expensive. I can live without saffron. I can't live without vanilla.
No.
So I was thinking about vanilla and some of the recipes that we have where vanilla is really a key ingredient,
yeah.
And it's surprisingly so. For example, a recipe that I don't make often enough, but I love, is my orange creamsicle ice cream.
Oh, I remember that.
And all it is two oranges, if you're making two servings, two oranges peeled, sectioned, and then frozen. And then when they're nice and frozen, then you can blend them with 1/4 cup of raw cashews, 1/2 cup of plain unsweetened non-dairy milk, and 1/2 teaspoon of vanilla. And that vanilla married with the oranges in that creamy cashew base is heaven.
Yes. And you need a high-powered blender.
Yes, you do.
And when the oranges are frozen, they really make a nice creamsicle consistency,
yeah,
in there. So
yeah,
it's very, very good.
And then another recipe where vanilla is a key ingredient is the raspberry vanilla cake.
Ooh, that was good. You haven't made that in ages.
I know. And it has a vegan buttercream frosting that also has vanilla in it.
Yeah.
It's very rich. It's very decadent. It's something that we don't have very often because it has a lot of things in it that we don't normally eat like sugar and vegan butter, but it's a really a great celebration, and vanilla is an important ingredient.
Right. We put vanilla in a lot of things. I know every morning when I steam my soy milk for my Ticino, I put a little drop of vanilla in the
milk. The difference, it makes it taste sweeter somehow.
Well, they sell vanilla-flavored soy milks, obviously, with sugar.
Sure.
And some without sugar. But it's just so easy to do it yourself, and you can control the vanilla. We can't live without vanilla. Now, something I learned in baking school, we used a lot of bourbon vanilla in baking school. You make it by getting a vanilla bean, splitting it down the middle, and putting it in a bottle of bourbon and then forgetting about it for several weeks. And then what you have is bourbon vanilla, which is instead of straight alcohol and vanilla bean, which is how they make vanilla extract, you're getting a bourbon flavored vanilla.
Well, we should do that.
We should definitely do that.
There's so many things we have to do. Another recipe that's completely different, where vanilla is also a key ingredient, is our frozen raw vanilla cream oatmeal cookies. And has anybody ever made this recipe? We have two frozen cream cookies. They
look
like Oreos.
Those were great.
But they're not. And they're so much better. And this recipe has a nice vanilla filling. It's made with cashews and just
yummy. Well, that is a beautiful recipe. The frozen raw vanilla cream oatmeal cookies is one of my favorite, and you haven't made those in a long time.
I know. There's just so many recipes to make.
And the cookie dough is so easy. It's 2/3 cups almonds, 1/3 cup Brazil nuts. And if you have tree nut allergies, use sunflower or pumpkin seeds, 1 cup of raisins, and 1/2 cup of rolled oats. And that's the crust. You blend that together, and it's just delicious.
It's really yummy. Now, we have to say, it's kind of raw. So
right.
It's raw in that it's not baked, but rolled oats, even when they're not cooked. Okay, we're hair splitting here. But rolled oats are not raw. They
right.
are lightly steamed at
right.
some point before they are actually packaged and shipped.
That's because they're rolling.
Yes.
They're rolling the oats.
Yes.
They're using a very heavy, what would you call it? Like a steamroller. To smash the oats, and that's why they call them rolled oats.
Yeah.
You know what this cookie reminds me of? Folks that live in the San Francisco Bay Area will get this. It reminds me of something that's called an Itzit. I don't know if you've ever had an Itzit. They're made in San Francisco, or at least they were made in San Francisco. It's a frozen ice cream cookie. So it's a frozen ice cream cookie sandwich. And these cookies, these frozen raw vanilla cream oatmeal cookies, remind me of an Itzit.
That's interesting. Better than an Itzit.
Oh, so much better. But that's why I love them so much.
Right. I remember Rice Dream. They probably still have it, but I just don't buy these things anymore. They had something similar where they had the two cookies and their Rice Dream in the middle.
Right, right. And here we are talking about ice cream and ice dream and
it's snowing
and
outside.
Frozen vanilla cookies and it's snowing outside.
What's wrong with us?
I think we just can't get enough of the cold vanilla yumminess.
Again, vanilla is really a miracle ingredient. It is expensive, and I'm just going to have a moment of gratitude here for the vanilla
yes.
that we are able to bring to our household and enjoy. What's the opposite of vanilla?
Chocolate?
Yeah, and it's not really an opposite, but that's what everybody would say, right? And
Valentine's Day
is coming around.
And a lot of people don't celebrate Valentine's Day, and that's cool. A lot of folks are anti-Valentine's Day, but chocolate seems to be the thing people are thinking about now because of the approaching...
Yeah, so whether you celebrate it or not, or you just like chocolate or not... I thought I'd mention a few chocolate recipes because I know what I'm making on Valentine's Day. And
yes.
Well, I'll give you a choice, Gary. But I've already decided. Your choice is going to be the chocolate cake that I made last year for your birthday and mine. The chocolate pumpkin mini cake with whipped pumpkin cream.
Oh, that's such a great
which
cake.
Which is really good. But I haven't made the flourless chocolate cake in a while, and I've kind of got a hankering for that one.
Definitely the flourless chocolate cake.
And like I always do, this is funny, I think. I'm laughing. I look at a recipe, and I can never follow it. I always have to make changes.
Right.
So I'm looking at the flourless chocolate cake recipe, which is a recipe I already modified from Candle Cafe's cookbook, Vegan Holiday Cooking.
Oh, I love that cookbook.
We love that cookbook. We love Joy Pearson and Bart Potenza.
Yes, we do.
We love the Candle restaurants, which are no longer. They are just in our delicious memories. And I'm looking at this recipe, which I said I already modified, and I'm thinking, I could modify this recipe.
Again.
Again.
So what would you do different this time?
Right. Well, in this recipe, and it's really a good recipe, it has in it agave or maple syrup in the crust, which I think I could easily change in dates to sweeten it up, or raisins. The crust consists of carrots, shredded coconut, almonds.
I remember,
and
yeah.
Then a sweetener. So we've made a million of those kinds of dough crusts.
Sure,
before.
You could use a dried fruit.
Just a dry fruit would work beautifully. And then the cake consists of almond meal, and I make my own from almonds. It has cocoa powder in it, baking powder, some non-dairy milk. And then it has some more agave or maple syrup, and olive oil, and brown sugar.
Right.
And
You might be able to leave the olive oil and the sugar out.
I might be able to.
Maybe do some.
So stay tuned.
So that will be interesting.
And if you don't like it, well.
I'm going to love it. Are you kidding?
But it's just funny because
It is.
I just keep.
Because you're my funny Valentine.
My funny Valentine. You make me smile.
That's why it's funny. And I'm really happy about the fact that you're my funny Valentine.
Yes, you're my funnier Valentine. Yeah. You're really the funny one.
I'm the funny one in the family. If you watched the Super Bowl, I was hearing stories. I didn't watch the Super Bowl, but I was hearing stories about the Oatly CEO who did a commercial, performs a vegan song during a Super Bowl ad. So that
it was funny. Now, some people didn't like it. But I thought it was great. Very simple and to the point. No cow.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. And apparently the musical commercial first aired in Sweden 7 years ago and features the lyrics composed by and performed by Oatly's CEO.
Oh, so he probably just translated it from Swedish into English.
Yeah, Oatly's Super Bowl ad debut featured a song about dairy-free milk written and performed by CEO Tony Peterson. The divisive advertisement first ran in Sweden back in 2014, but it was immediately banned following a lawsuit from the National Dairy Lobby.
Mm.
Peterson composed the song for the Wow No Cow commercial himself. It features lyrics such as, "It's like milk, but made for humans." A 30-second cut of the full 60-second commercial ran during Super Bowl 55. Sunday, 2 days ago. Since the game, it has received a great deal of attention on Twitter and in the media. However, Oatly was clearly prepared for a mixed reaction, and the company already sold out of its free "I totally hated that Oatly commercial" t-shirts. Now, there's a guy.
I was a sense of humor.
Who really has, talking about my funny Valentine being
right.
You. This guy's funny, and he knows how to make a joke. It's the milk but made for humans. That little commercial got so much attention and is probably going to do more good to influence a lot of folks into maybe thinking about changing
their
beverage choice.
Because at the same time, I like to talk about good news, but I have to just air something here because I was frustrated listening to a program. I listen to WNYC a lot. They were talking about a new cookbook that's coming out called Dinner in French by New York Times star food writer Melissa Clark. And she was talking about this cookbook. And some of it sounded pretty interesting, but the frustrating thing about it was how heavy it was in meat and cheese. And she even admitted that she's trying to cut back on consuming meat. She says there's plenty of vegetarian recipes in this book, but they're vegetarian with eggs and cream and butter.
Liquid meat.
And here it is. The concept of this book is taking what Julia Child did in the 20th century with French cooking and now bringing it to the 21st century. And Melissa Clark is doing that, or so the publicity says, what this book is doing, making the food more amenable to what we buy and how we cook in the 21st century and what we're looking to eat today. And it's not going far enough.
No.
So I just wanted to put that out there to the universe. We need a better French cookbook.
Exactly.
Making all those wonderful French recipes just with complete plant ingredients.
Well, now you're someone who has, for the last how many years, read lots and lots of cookbooks. Have you seen a vegan French cookbook?
Oh, I'm sure there are.
I mean, but in your
travels. I have not.
No. I mean, I'm looking at our cookbook collection now and I don't see any vegan.
We don't have one, but there's got to be one out there.
And that was one of the things that we wanted to do when we were doing the transition kitchen and playing around with that concept, was to do a vegan French take. And I remember doing several sauces that are in the first chapter of the classic French cuisine, the sauces that you learn how to make when you make French food. And it's very difficult without a lot of the animal products, but it's not impossible. You can get the taste very close. Like, for example, hollandaise. We've made a vegan hollandaise. There are several recipes on the internet. We have a great one.
Absolutely. And a bechamel.
And
your
again,
bechamel is amazing, Gary.
And one of the other things, getting back to the vanilla, is a crème anglaise, which you can easily make with vanilla bean and cashew milk, which is a great sauce for cakes and pies and cookies and all kinds of things. I think it's something someone should tackle and try to do a vegan version.
I'm going to have to look. There's got to be one out there.
I mean, really classic French cuisine, only
yes.
vegan.
Only vegan, yes.
Yeah, that would be difficult, but not impossible.
Not.
Especially now with a lot of the plant meats that are coming out, you could actually do some of the traditional French roasted poultry dishes and steak au poivre. I wonder how a steak tartare made with with a ground Beyond Burger would taste.
Yeah.
Raw. Probably pretty bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't want
to go
there.
We don't have to go there.
But I've done something similar with carpaccio. Again, it's at the Responsible Eating, speaking of French cuisine and classic Italian cuisines, where carpaccio is pounded raw filet mignon. I've done a vegan version by marinating sun-dried tomatoes and pounding them the same way you would pound the raw filet. And it's delicious.
Yeah.
It's our sun-dried tomato carpaccio. It's fantastic. And I'm not the one that invented it, I'm sure, but I thought I did at the time.
Now, the challenge there is finding an organic sun-dried tomato that doesn't come in oil, right?
No, you could use it in oil, but we used the organic sun-dried tomatoes that were dried.
They weren't. And they're hard to find.
And we rehydrated them a little bit. And of course, you can find organic capers, and you can make an organic mayo that you drizzle on. It's a mayo sauce. It was based on the recipe from Harry's Bar and American Grill in Venice. That's where the recipe originated. But you could also do a steak tartare with sun-dried tomatoes. It's awfully good. It's delicious. Anyway, it's difficult, but it's not impossible. And with a little imagination and some quality ingredients, I think someone could do a classic French cookbook vegan. But I can see why she didn't, because it's very difficult.
I just think it's perception. I don't think it's because it's difficult.
I don't either, but I know for a lot of people it's a lot of trouble, and it's a lot easier just to call it vegetarian and use...
Yeah, and grate your Gruyere on it.
You know, speaking of grating your Gruyere on it, you make a wonderful vegan French onion soup.
That's coming too. I think I'm going to serve French onion soup with that flourless chocolate cake.
Yeah, and your French onion soup, veganized French onion soup,
is amazing.
Tastes like the classic.
It does.
French onion soup.
Well, at least what I remember. I haven't had one of those in...
Yeah, well, I mean, my memory is...
decades.
I've been a vegan now a lot less time than you have, and I can remember the taste is still in my head, and when I taste yours, it's fantastic.
Mm.
That used to be my go-to meal before vegan was...
French onion soup.
French onion
a
soup.
A little salad.
Salad and a big burger.
Mm.
Lots of fries. You can hear your heart. You can hear your arteries hardening for miles away when you have a meal like that. That isn't plant-based.
Well, last year at this time, we were talking with the woman from Sweet Vegan.
Right.
Remember? And we all met in this PRN studio.
Oh, I miss the PRN studio.
Yes. If anybody's looking for vegan chocolates, I just want to put out Andrea Young's Sweet Vegan.
Yes.
It's a very high quality selection of different chocolates, fresh ingredients, organic, and she's sensitive to those with allergies. So her chocolates have no nuts or soy, and they're gluten free.
And they're delicious.
And I will say, yes, they are expensive, but all the ingredients are high quality. And for a treat, for a special moment, it fits the bill.
I hope Andrea is selling out of chocolates because she's a very nice person.
Yes, a very sweet vegan.
She's a very sweet vegan. Yes.
And so are you, Gary. You're a sweet vegan.
Ah, thanks, Karen.
And I just want to wrap this up now and thank all the sweet vegans that are out there and all the sweet wannabe vegans or the sweet vegan in transition folks that are out there and those who are taking the veggie pledge right now and are finding their way towards eating more plants and less meat. Thank you.
That was a great show you had last week.
I'm getting the posts every day from the Veguary campaign.
Great.
And they really put together a very nice program with food shows, meditation videos, yoga videos. It's just a really nice collection. And if you haven't signed up yet, you can. It's free. Go to afrovegansociety.org.
Excellent, excellent, excellent advice. I think everyone should go there.
Yeah. There's also great quotes and lessons in history for Black History Month. So all in all, it's worth the price.
And the price is?
Free.
It's free. Oh my gosh, all of that for free? Well, that's just like us. All of this for free. Well, what a great time I had today coming back on the show and wrapping things up with you. I hope to see you next week as well, Karen. Meanwhile, happy, 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 happy Heart Day.
Happy Heart Day.
Because it's Heart Month.
It's Heart Month, too.
Right. So we can't forget that.
No. Take care of your hearts, everybody. And have a delicious week.